So I'm going to talk about a topic which is maybe a little bit unusual for me, or for a Buddhist teacher. And I thought I would talk about politics. And maybe you came here to get away from that. And but I think that for some people, what's happening in the world is very much on their minds, whether it's in Middle East or in this country or all kinds of places. And when I go around, sometimes talk informally with people, it seems to turn towards politics quite a bit lately. I don't know if it's more than usual, but at least in my circles, it seems to be. And one of the things that I'm sometimes asked is, what does Buddhism have to say about politics? And sometimes one answer that's given is nothing. Is that Buddhism should not get involved in the political sphere at all. And another answer is that is everything. That you cannot separate out. Excuse me. You cannot separate out daily life, community life, civic life, political life from a person's spiritual life and practice life, that they're all inseparable whole. And so a Buddhist practice life has to somehow also address political life. So if you go back to Buddhism as a resource for political theory or political thought, what is it that Buddhist wisdom or Buddhist insight has to say about politics? What's if you have the insight-based approach to politics, what do you get? And some of what I'm going to say applies to any kind of interpersonal relationship where there is conflict and tension, or where something has to be solved or figured out. It doesn't necessarily at the level of government. But how does power work? One of the things that the Buddha emphasized over and over again is that is non-violence, non-aggression, non-hostility, and that when there is victory, when someone is victorious, then someone else is unhappy, someone else is defeated. And that unhappiness is a distress for the person who's lost. And it's been pointed out that one of the big problems of pure democracy is the tyranny of the majority. And so, in fact, America does not have a pure democracy. It has a structure that was originally set in place to have a check and balance system so that the abuses of a single ruler could be check and balances, and the abuses of democracy could be a check and balance for that. So, and then built in is the idea that there can be problems if you just vote and one person wins and one person loses. So how do you take care of the rights of the minority? So in Buddhism, there's an interest in finding some approach to moving forward in the civic level or interpersonal level that's not oppositional. So is there some way of engaging in a political life that doesn't set one person against the other, one party against the other? And I hear in my circles a lot now about trying to somehow come up with a liberal religious voice in this country in order to counter the religious right. They've had their say in the public arena, and the liberal religious worlds haven't had much a say in the last decade or two, and so they should kind of rally and be a counterforce to the religious right. Or the Democrats have to figure out some way to regain the upper hand. And that kind of language approach is oppositional. One party wins and the other party loses. One's on top, one's not. And the idea of insight or wisdom, a Buddhist based approach to political life, is to try very hard to avoid situations which are oppositional, or solutions where one person is defeated. So how can we engage in a civic life that doesn't involve someone being defeated? So there are seven then principles or qualities of a wisdom or insight-based approach to politics. And the approaches to that, to kind of go forward, trying to move civic life forward in healthy ways, that's trying to avoid oppositional quality that often comes into play. And these seven are what we could call here, this is our call today, translate today as presence, investigation, effort, happiness, peace, focus, concentration, and equanimity. And so the first one, presence, that insight-based politics requires presence. You have to be present. And, you know, there's this famous saying in America, no taxation without representation. Well, Buddhists maybe would say, no representation without presence, without being present. And I say that because it's often the case that people will make decisions for others far removed from them. And there can be oppositional qualities that get set up in place without actually knowing the opposition, knowing who they are. And I see that taking place in my own life, in myself, that I could, you know, emails are so dangerous, right? You say something in email and it's completely misunderstood because the affect, the emotional quality of how you're saying it doesn't come through the email. So you thought you were being very warm and loving and they thought you were being terse and, you know, and they just couldn't feel the way you felt because it's not there in the words. And so one of the things I've learned is that if I'm feeling some kind of tension with someone, it's very important for me to get into their presence. Phone call is maybe sometimes the best I can do, but actually kind of get together with them and meet with them. Because inevitably I find that the tensions I feel with someone, and sometimes the maybe little resentments, annoyances I have about them and what they're doing, what they're thinking, has a lot to do with my imagination, not about who they really are. And if I could actually meet them, then it breaks through the imagination, and also I get to see a more fuller spectrum, dimension of who that person is. And I find that inevitably, my sense of I'm in conflict with this person dissolves pretty quickly if I'm actually talking and meeting the person. And that's been my experience lately. So I look for opportunities to meet the people that I'm in tension with or some difficulty with. Recently, I would, so presence. And so, do we know the people we're making decisions for? One of the reasons I like, you know, having the abortion protesters here Thursdays and Friday mornings. I don't know if you've been here. Some of you have been here, seen it. There's a huge protest that goes on here at our corner Thursday and Friday mornings because across the street is Planned Parenthood. And without taking a side necessarily for or against abortion, I think it's valuable to be present for this fault line in American society. It's a huge fault line around abortion. And until I came here to this corner, and we moved here 4 years ago, the abortion debate was something that was, you know, I had opinions about, but mostly it was far away. You know, it was something somewhere else. And it's quite something to have it on our sidewalk. You know, you know, you can actually witness it. You can hang out there on the sidewalk a little bit and you actually see the tension. The fellow who's a main protester out there protesting the abortions, a year and a half ago, someone tried to run him over right here. And the person who tried to run him over got arrested, you know. It's a pretty, it's pretty tense out there. Some people feel it shouldn't be there, that we should do something about getting them to go away. And maybe, I don't know. But I value the fact that we're present for that tension. It's in my mind, it's something I'm aware of. It's very different than when, you know, when it was just some, I'd read about it in the paper far, far from here. So to find some way to be present for the decisions we have to make, or politicians, who are insight approach to politics, but actually go and be present in the places that are going to be affected by their decisions. Meet the people who are going to be affected, see the environment, see what's going on. And without that kind of sense of presence, there isn't really an understanding, perhaps, of what needs to be done. There's a lot of misunderstanding that can happen. The second approach of an insight-based politics is investigation. And this is really to understand deeply, try to investigate and uncover what's really going on here. And I was, a big influence in my life was the fact that when I went to college, when I last 2 years in college, I dropped out of college and went back. And when I went back to study agriculture. I have a degree in agriculture. I'm an agronomist. My degree is in the art and science of field crop management. Wonder what I'm doing in Redwood City. I was quite passionate about it. I loved farming. I was really going to go into that line of work. And I was also a born-again organic farmer. And I had been trained a little bit in organic farming and studied a lot and was quite idealistic and had very strong opinions about organic farming. And actually, when I went to UC Davis to get my degree, I was one of the kind of alternatives in agriculture activists on campus there. We actually did a lot in those 2 years. But one of the things that was quite humbling for me was to begin taking classes in science, the science of farming, in particular the science of soil, and to realize that some of my ideas about organic farming, there was no science behind them. In fact, the science behind them were the opposite. And some of the kind of popular idealistic ideas about organic farming were just that. They were kind of unfounded idealism that maybe was generalizing about particular areas, but it was kind of vast generalization. And this generalization that then it was applying some principle to everything and realizing that it wasn't always true was quite humbling for me and quite a kind of wake-up call for me. And when I got involved in religion, in Buddhism, I had the suspicion that religious people have a greater tendency to generalize than organic farmers. So it became very important for me also to kind of be very careful as I engaged in a spiritual life and thought, to be very careful and considerate about my investigation, my understanding, so as not to generalize too easily or too quickly about this is what the truth is. So to investigate and study what's really here. And sometimes I'm embarrassed to read some of the newspapers that I read because of what statements that are made on the front page that are generalizations, that are opinions, sometimes somewhat hidden, sometimes not so hidden. Sometimes I read the Chronicle and read a liberal bent in an article. I'm basically liberal myself, but I really am annoyed when the news I get is spun towards a liberal kind of direction, and just as much as I'm annoyed spun in another direction. So I try to find ways to get the news when I read it that is offers different perspectives, so I'm not kind of stuck with one perspective. I think I'd be really terrible if all we did was read liberal magazines or conservative magazines, and that was our only perspective on society. So one of the things I try to do is to read European newspapers, because they have a very different understanding of what goes on in America, what's going on in the world, than American newspapers do. And so I try to get a balance of kind of a different perspective or a different understanding from doing that. So to investigate, to take the time to look more deeply and probe, to do the research, to really understand what is going on. And one of the reasons I was having some discussion this weekend about politics was that I was having lunch yesterday with a friend of mine who just wrote a book called On the Road to 9/11, which is being published by UC Berkeley Press. And it's the first study of 9/11 being published by University Press. He spent, since 9/11. And actually, in some ways, the research for him started before that. Years and years of study. And what he has to say is so consequential that UC Press is not going to print it until it goes through the lawyers. And he's a little bit sad because the release is going to be delayed because the lawyers are actually quite slow going through it carefully to make sure that it's not going to be liable. But, you know, 5 years of this careful kind of painstaking investigation this whole thing. So investigation, and not to have simplistic ideas or quick ideas or opinionated ideas, but rather take the time to really understand. And for me, part of that means is to be very wise about how we use opinions, how we come to opinions, and the role of opinions in our life. Because opinions, more often than not, are going to be shallow. And so to not succumb to opinions or sound bites, but to actually read the article all the way through, or read a different article, or several articles, or read. Or for the politicians, to study and investigate more deeply. And part of the reason why that's important in a non-oppositional form of politics is that there are times when the information, when everyone has it, sometimes it's very difficult. Everyone has the same information and they spin it, they understand it differently. But sometimes when you get all the information out there, it becomes much more obvious to everyone what the issues are. And I think this is one of the reasons why in some countries journalists are endangered species. They don't want to get the information out there. And even in this country, there seems to be sometimes pressure on the media one way or the other. The next thing is a quality of insight-based politics is effort or energy. And one of my favorite kind of theological jokes is some person died and went to heaven and finally had a chance to complain to God. You know, it's a mess down there. People are starving, people are killing each other, and there's natural disasters. All these terrible things are happening. Do something. God, do something. So God said, I did do something. I made you. So this tendency of, expecting other people to do something, it's up to someone else. They have to do it. Effort means that we can make the effort. We get involved. Don't pass on the buck and then complain because other people are supposed to do it, and it's easy to be kind of backseat drivers in politics. I think an insight-based approach to politics that's trying to heal the oppositions and divisions requires engagement, effort, energy to get involved and do something, to follow through, to be engaged. In the Buddhist tradition, sometimes this word for energy, virya, also has the quality of persistence. But hang in there, and over the long term. Sometimes political life doesn't lend itself to easy solutions. I remember once I helped the San Francisco Zen Center with their... they realized at some point after all the scandals in American Buddhism in the 1980s that Zen Center needed an ethics document with a code of ethics for the teachers and a process of dealing with conflict. And so they had a committee put together that document. And then the committee presented it to the board and the community. And I've been involved with Zen Center for, since 1975 or something, on and off. You know pretty well what goes on in that community. And I have never seen so much conflict at Zen Center as I saw around trying to get this document approved by the community, a document on ethics. And I was on the board at Zen Center, and board members were standing up yelling at each other across a table about a document that was supposed to help them deal with conflict. and so it was clearly at an impasse. So it looked like nothing was going to happen. It was probably, just couldn't happen. and then I came up with a little idea that might... for the way of the community to find its way forward with this thing. And so they liked my idea so much that they put me on the next committee. and I realized that if this ethics document was going to get through the community, it needed to have... the community had to have consensus around it. And the whole community had to somehow be involved in shaping and approving this document. And I realized this was going to take a lot of energy. It was going to take a lot of time. It would have been a lot easier if people just understood my infinite wisdom and that I, of course, am right and just accepted what I had to say. But what I realized was going to take a lot of effort, a lot of time. And it took maybe 2.5 years to do this process. I went up to Zen Center once a week for meetings where we painstakingly went through this document and then was sent out to different subcommittees of Zen Center, different people, and different this and that, and worked on it. Until finally, when it was time to ratify the document, I think basically, the board yawned. it was like a non-issue. Should we pass it? Well, what's next on the agenda? Sure. Whereas the first attempt, literally people were screaming and yelling and cursing each other. These were people who had been, Zen students. A very, very contentious issue. So energy, putting time in to do the work that it takes to bring people on board, to have consensus, to have agreement, to hear everybody out, to be able to work through the different things. One of the things I've learned over and over again, but I learned it there at Zen Center also, in this process of the ethics document, was we had a small committee of about 4 of us who were the main people kind of in crafting this new document. And, every comma was discussed and argued, And we also sometimes had a little tension among ourselves around this ethics document we were writing, a little committee, because we had different opinions about how it should be worded and what should be said and what should be about. And, we had one person had one idea and the other person a different idea. And sometimes we'd reach a kind of impasse. And sometimes people would say, well, we can't seem to get a way forward, so I'll let you have your way, or, you should let me have my way or something. And I say, no. Let's stay in conflict. It's really good to stay in conflict or stay in the tension. Maybe tension's a better word. Let's stay in the tension of not agreeing. And let's hang in there and keep the discussion going. Because if you stay in the tension, if you stay with put energy and presence there, then perhaps a new solution will arise, a new possibility will arise that can't arise unless you stay in the area of tension. So put energy into and have the wisdom to know how to stay in tension so that new possibilities can arise that work for everybody. So to stay in there, put the energy in it, is another and the third quality. The fourth quality is happiness. Is there happiness for everyone involved in this process? Can there be happiness for everyone? To have that as an ideal. Many religious people, like the Dalai Lama and Plato and different people have said that one of the, William James and different people, that one of the highest goals that many religious people have, or many people have, is happiness. That kind of it's one of the great goals, and so one way or other, people are trying to be happy, and to have to realize that that's also part of political life, and to consider is the gross national happiness of a country as opposed to its gross national product. I don't know how many of you read the paper last week, where they said the happiest place in the world was a little island in the Pacific called Vatanao. Andrea, how do you pronounce it? Vanuatu. And Andrea Fella was the Peace Corps there. You can ask her if people were happy. Anyway, they have some index. I'm from Norway originally, and when I was back in Norway, I remember in the late 80s, they did a study of Norwegians, survey of Norwegians, and asked how many of them were less happy then than they were 10 years earlier. And the great majority of Norwegians felt that they were actually happier 10 years before. Interesting. But no one was willing to go back to 10 years before. Mm-hmm. But somehow the way the society had developed and grown, it hadn't actually made them happier, even though the country became more affluent. So to consider happiness as an important quality. And in recent years, there's been a lot of studies on happiness. A lot of books have been published on it. And more like scientific studies or psychological studies on it. So I think we have much better understanding about happiness than we've ever had before. And so rather than looking for, right and wrong or victory, what is the way that finds happiness for people, makes everyone happy? Is there such a way? Is there such a thing? And then the next one is peace. To have peace or tranquility is an important quality, both in the engagement in political activity and as the goal of political activity. I haven't known too many people involved with politics lately in the way that I knew many years ago. But there's a lot of people I know who've come to Buddhism in the 60s and early 70s because they were involved in the radical politics of the 60s and were so bitterly disappointed at the heavy-handed approach or the power play or the conflict or the fighting, infighting, or the sexism that existed in the radical movement in the 60s. And they were so discouraged by it, they left it in order to find some other way of engaging in a wiser life. And then people I know, you know, found Buddhism. But to make being at peace a quality of how we engage in politics. So it's not the politics of anger. It's not the politics of fear. And that's a huge order, because I think fear and anger is kind of, you know, something which is, comes very readily to all of us. And I think, you know, it's not uncommon for me to hear people who are really furious at some of the political leaders that are around. And I don't know if it's so useful to be angry. It's certainly okay to be, to not be supportive and not agree with them. But can we find a place to be effective in the world without being angry? I think it's one of the great challenges in all situations, how to be effective. I see it with my children. I find being a parent to be quite a challenge, these younger kids. And there are times when I've felt like, you know, I just reached the end of my line. I just, something has to happen here. And sometimes I've used a very strong voice. I call it my strong voice. No, stop that. Go to your room or something. And my wife hasn't approved of this strong voice I can use. And it's very effective. You know, the problem stops. Great. Well, that's what you need to do. You set limits and be strong and great. Some days later, a week later, you hear exactly the same tone of voice being directed to the younger brother. Or the younger brother, you know, the age of, you know, 2 and 3, you know, some kids are just kind of these sponges. They used to learn how to copy. They're learning how to be in the world by copying how other people are. And so they hear anger, you know, and they think, oh, that's how you're supposed to do. And they go around experimenting with their anger. Or that's what they do. So, you know, so it can seem as anger and violence can be effective in the moment sometimes to get some result. But I think in the long term, it's counterproductive. So are there other ways of working with people that's not oppositional? And so it takes a lot of work, certainly with parenting, to find that way. And but also at the political level, can we find a way where peace is really the forefront of how we are in the world and also the goal for what we're trying to attain and reach? If we're trying to be at peace with the opposition, then we can't, you know, we have to be peaceful towards them and find a way to go forward and find a way to deal with the differences that is not oppositional and looking for conquest or victory. So they have the idea of peace at the forefront of the considerations. Then the fifth quality is focus or concentration. And it's a little bit like energy, but this is like to keep the focus. And sometimes picking one cause, picking one thing, and really being focused and following it through all the way. I'm quite inspired by people who have chosen one thing and just stayed on it. Like the woman who got the Nobel Peace Prize some years ago because of her opposition to landmines. She picked up one thing and just stayed on with letters and wrote letters and wrote letters and stayed on this one thing with landmines and made a difference and eventually got the Nobel Prize. Or, you know, if Martin Luther King had decided after 3 or 4 years, well, that's enough. You know, I think I'll try something else. You know, it took years and years of effort, of persistence, of focus. And part of this, you know, learning how to be peaceful, at ease, is to allow, you know, is support, the fuel for allowing us to stay focused on what we're doing. I'm also somewhat, I think, it's very instructive. What I'm reading about, at least, about how in the late 60s and early 70s, the conservative right was very alarmed by what was happening in this country with the liberal direction the country was taking. And they made made choices back then that slowly and carefully put together the pieces that 20 years later would give them control of the government. 20 years is, you know, maybe not so long, but also a long time. Slow and steady, keeping the focus. The long term, over the long term. Part of keeping the focus is actually having a long term vision. I read once in some book that had nothing to do with Buddhism that teaching people to be in the here and now is a capitalist dream. Isn't that interesting? I mean, because then you don't think about the future and the consequences for the future. You just buy, and don't think about the results. So to have some concern for long-term, you know, long-term focus, a focus and kind of concentration, what's this going to be like in the long term? And then the final aspect in Buddhism of, you know, the insight-based approach to politics is equanimity. Equanimity is a hugely important quality in Buddhist practice, but often misunderstood because it can seem like indifference or aloofness. Equanimity is the ability to stay present, alert, peaceful, without getting caught in the worlds of opposition, for and against, without being caught. The world is being, the operating word is being caught, without losing your peace, without getting reactive to what's going on. And I think that Martin Luther King knew this very well, that it was his movement, the civil rights movement, was not going to work in America unless they were able to, the civil rights people were not, it wasn't going to work unless they kept their equanimity. I don't think he used that word, but it comes to the same thing. So the story, I was teaching on retreat once, and this woman came and told me the story of when she went down, it was a white woman, and she went down to the South in the 60s to be part of the civil rights movement. And she said she stood on a street corner doing some protest. And these rednecks, racists, came along in their pickup truck and saw them there and jumped out of the pickup truck and came over and started to beat them up, pounding them away. So she got beat up. So apparently not too bad, because the next day she came to like the same street corner and they stood there again. The same guys came along and jumped out of the pickup truck and did some more beating of them. So, what did they do? The next day, they went back to the same street corner. And the next time, the guy was standing over her with his fist poised to strike. And he looked at her and he said, "What are you doing?" And instead of being beat up, they had a conversation. Isn't that something? I think that's remarkable. That takes equanimity. That takes an ability not to get caught up in reactivity. It takes a lot of bravery. And it takes some understanding, a focus of, you know, where power can reside. There's tremendous power in that ability to nonviolent resistance in the face of even violence. When the Czechoslovakia had this nonviolent protest against Russia in 1967, Czechoslovakia almost became free of Russia. And what happened in those weeks was that the Russian soldiers who were there kind of to quell the Czechoslovakians, they couldn't fight. And what Russia had to do, eventually Russia was able to squash the protest. But what Russia had to do is they had to bring the soldiers out of Czechoslovakia and send new ones in. New ones who hadn't encountered the Czechoslovakians putting flowers in their rifles and offering flowers and doing things to them. And people who hadn't been softened, hadn't had that presence of meeting someone right? The people who had been indoctrinated, maybe, oh, those are the enemy. And they had to do like several rounds before the Russians could actually kind of lay their protest down. So the ability to deal with opposition, deal with conflict, even violence, with equanimity, to deal with presence, to have the wisdom and understanding of when it's appropriate to do this. And I think there's at times high risk with kind of the maintaining a non-violent approach, which is really central to this insight approach to politics, because violence is always going to be oppositional. And when you use violence to get your way, the opponent is going to feel terrible. And sometimes then it comes back to the next generation when it's extreme forms of violence. I'm amazed, now that I'm getting old enough to be amazed at certain things, how long the pain lasts from war. There are people who are still dealing with the civil war in this country. I meet people who are still dealing with Armenian massacres and genocide that was almost 100 years ago in Turkey. Still deeply painful, still going to deeply influence who they are. And some years ago, I remember giving a talk here. I just come back. I've gone back to Norway, where I'm from. And I brought my son, who was 5 years old. And so I'm Norwegian. And my wife, her family comes from Holland. And her parents were Dutch Jews who went through the concentration camps and managed to get out. Their parents all died, and most of the family died, but my wife's parents survived the concentration camps in Germany. And so I took my 5-year-old son back to Norway. And I remember just mentioning it here, I took him back to the farm in a little teeny little place in Norway. There's like 5 farms. That's called Fransdal. I'd never been there myself. It's like where, you know, in 1848 or 1860, my family kind of came from, this little teeny place. So I got to show my son, you know, where his father's side of the family came from. It was kind of nice. And then I didn't tell the people here, but I actually started choking up as I said this, because I thought, and when am I going to tell him about his grandparents on the mother's side? Their pain, their suffering. And actually, you know, and I thought, it's been 50 years. Or more, and I'm still kind of get choked up about something. You know, I wasn't even alive then. War that long ago, the effect of it. So you know, it goes on and on. The effect, which is amazing. If we did a cost analysis of some of these decisions, you know, and take into account 50 years. So you know, violence can seem to have immediate effect. But nonviolence has a very different effect. Violence has an effect that lasts a long time. Nonviolence is a very different one. You know, the work in South Africa on the Peace and Reconciliation, the Truth and Reconciliation Council, I think is a phenomenal thing what they did there. And there also, you know, so much of that, what happened in South Africa, happened nonviolently. Even though there was violence part of the scene there, it was basically a nonviolent movement. To me, it's phenomenally inspiring. But I say all this because to have the ability, the presence, the strength, the energy, the commitment to be non-oppositional in our conflict, or non-conflictional in our opposition, come to work through and not be in opposition, not to see the person as the enemy, and to be willing to be beat up, sometimes means being willing to die. And there are people in our country who are willing to die as soldiers, and we're willing to send people elsewhere to die for us. And I think that there have been conflicts that have been resolved nonviolently in the last century, where some of the people who fought for this nonviolent cause died in that process. But a lot fewer people died than if they picked up arms. So So Gandhi, for example, his movement, there were people who died. And he refused to pick up guns. Civil rights, people who died, and they didn't pick up guns. And some of the power of that was because they were willing to stand there in nonviolent opposition. So equanimity is the stepping stone in Buddhism to freedom. And if freedom is also one of the main guiding functions of insight-based politics, then we need to understand that equanimity and peace and all these different qualities that I'm talking about tonight are things that have to be mobilized and energized and engaged in so that we can find a way of being involved politically that is not going to perpetuate conflict and division. It's easy to be divisive. It's not easy to heal the divisions. So I would rather that we start a conversation in America not about, you know, let's have a liberal religious movement to balance, you know, the conservative right. I would rather have a movement that found some way to heal the divisions. Is it naive? That's possible? That's for you to decide. So I think that it's possible for Buddhists to be political. And I think that some of these principles that Buddhism doesn't have a lot to say about politics, but it has some things. And these seven principles of an insight-based approach to politics is one of the things it has to offer. So. Now I'm very curious what you think of that talk. But it's 9 o'clock, so I won't find out. Maybe I've created too much division here, bringing up politics. So thank you very much.